Welcome to Emotional Sobriety.
I'm so grateful to be back on the podcast with Alan and Tom. Last weekend, we took a sabbatical for some very important resetting, at least on Alan's side. He had some family business to attend to. It was very meaningful. I'm sure he'll get into as much as he feels comfortable getting into. But I'd just like to go around and give everybody the opportunity to check in with our audience. How's it going, Alan and Tom?
Yeah, you guys pronounced me the healthiest person in the group earlier by email, and I got to tell you, I'm proud. I'd like to thank the little people who helped me with that, and you guys too. It's like, that's right. It really brought to mind that I've been pressure washing the outside of my house, my deck and front porch all day long, and the contrast of that in the last many months of my not having any energy at all is wonderful. So when I got pronounced the healthiest person in the group, I really felt it. So. Well, I'm grateful, big time grateful.
That makes me feel good that because I truly meant that when I said that, and it didn't occur to me when I said it that you might get a positive charge out of me saying it. Mm-hmm. I was just making a declaration of fact. So the fact that it actually like went in and like did something somewhere, because at the time I said it, I just felt like shit. I was just like, God, well, at least Tom's feeling better. Jesus.
Well, you made me feel even better. So that I appreciate it. Thank you.
Yeah.
Well, I went back to California to say goodbye to my son-in-law. He died of a heroin overdose. His name was Eric. And it was a very, very sad occasion. But it was also really a celebration of his life. I mean, there's so many high points. I'll share I got up and said a few things about, you know, his suffering. And you know, what I said was, because he struggled with getting recovery for a long time. I mean, it's got to be, I've known him for probably 10 years, and he'd get a year at a time, then he'd lose it, then he'd get a couple weeks and lose it, then days and lose it, on and off and on and off. So what happened was, is that they took his ashes and they went out on a boat, which I couldn't go because of my leg. And then 25 of his friends paddled out on surfboards and put a big circle around the boat as they said their goodbye to him and lowered his ashes into the ocean. I mean, what a cool ceremony. Then they came back to the yacht club, and that's where I got up and I said a few things, and I'll just paraphrase it real quick. I said, you know, life is difficult. I mean, there's no question about it. Scott Peck said that. And this is one of those difficult moments, saying goodbye to someone we all care about. And I said, you know, he suffered terribly. And the only way this poor soul could get any freedom from his suffering was to use alcohol and other drugs. And he tried many, many times to get sobriety, but it was elusive to him. And I says, but, you know, let's not let his suffering and his death go without us learning something from it. And then I talked about the three lessons that we could learn from what he did. As I said, first of all, you got to deal with your demons, man. You got to deal with the ghosts that are rattling their chains inside you. That's the only way to freedom. You can't avoid them. You can't drink them away. You can't drug them away. They're always going to be there until you face them. And I always throw out the quote from Tom where he says, you know, go to the past and learn as much from it as you can and resolve as many things as you can and get the hell out of there.
That's right.
I mean, I think that that's so much wisdom in that. And I said, the second thing to learn is you just cannot cut and paste today's reality into tomorrow. You just can't do it. I mean, you know, we take for granted what's going to happen. And we hear this so many times, Tom, you had to face that with the cancer diagnosis. Mm-hmm. You know, one day you don't have cancer, the next day you do. And, you know, what do you do with that? Well, you wake up. It's a wake-up call. Eric never got the wake-up call. I said, you know what he would have done if he knew that the night that he used was his last night on Earth? I think he would have spent it loving his children instead of being isolated out. And then I think the third thing we can learn from him, he was a big dreamer, which I think many of us are at times, right? But he could never mobilize himself to realize his dreams. They were ideas that just frustrated him and made him feel ashamed of himself because he never went after him. He was always afraid, or something was always in the way, perfectionism or whatever it is. But I said, the third lesson is, man, go after your dreams, man. If you have them, don't wait. You may never get a chance to realize them.
Amen.
So it was very powerful, man. It was very, and then his six-year-old gets up afterwards. This was what made it a celebration for me. He gets up and says, I'm Dax, I'm Eric's son. And he turns to me, I says, well, how was that for you, son, Dax? He says, Papa, that was the best day of my life. I go, what made that the best day of your life? He says, I've never heard so many people talk so positively about my daddy. How about that? What did he teach us right there? I mean, what a lesson, man. What a lesson.
He told us, pay attention to what's going on right this moment. That's what you do.
That's what he did. That's what he did, man. And he just really, really appreciated that inside he could hold an image of his dad that was positive, not just all these negative things about his addiction and who he wasn't.
Yeah, he'll take that with him.
Yeah, I was so moved by that.
Beautiful.
How are you, Patrick? How have you been?
You know, I've been so-so. I just wanted to remark that I appreciate so much the amount of, like, sympathy and love that you included in your remembrance of him, and the framing of sobriety as this elusive thing that, like, many people have trouble attaching to, because there is a solution in the using and drinking. It's a solution that drives us to death and other forms of misery. But it's important to acknowledge that, you know, there was a logic at play there.
There was, man, wasn't there?
Really? He sounds like a good guy.
Well, I really, really loved him. I got up and said, I didn't think of him as a son-in-law. I thought of him as a son. And I really, that's very true. That's very true.
Well, I'm so sorry for your loss. You know, I don't know. You're such a busy guy. It's like hard to know how much I should, what you know, when I should flag you down about something like this, even something so important. But
there's always room in my life for you. I love you, man.
I love
you
too.
It was so great to see you in person. I mean, we got to sit across from each other out and behind my daughter's home out in her patio. And got to sit there and chat with you, and it was wonderful.
Yeah, you know, life can get so full, and there's so much happening in any one moment on any given day that one thing I'm grateful for with my sobriety is that I have a level of consciousness and attunement where I can really appreciate just kind of sitting with Alan and just being able to chat for an hour. And I'm sure countless things were whirling by me during my using time that are forever moments that will be lost to me because I just was not present to appreciate them. And I really, you know, like, especially when somebody passes away from this illness and I'm still here and somehow, you know, I made it through the hailstorm, it just really it re-incentivizes me to, like, to hang on as long as I can and just really try and just squeeze as much as I can out of this orange.
Right.
Even if it's not always pleasant, you know, like I got some bad medical news recently. I had a bad injury at the end of last year because of a rock climbing accident, which required a surgery in my knee. And now I'm realizing, there was an MRI result that tells me that I'm going to need to go and undergo further surgery and go through another period of immobility and, you know, physical therapy and just all this. It's basically just an extension and possibly even like a retread of some of what I just went through with this injury. And it's knocked me asunder a little bit, like just in terms of I think my expectations were tagged to a kind of a certain date of recovery, a certain kind of like attaining what I lost in terms of getting around and, you know, being the type of person that I used
well,
to be.
Which is normal, by the way, Patrick. I mean, they give you some time frame. We want some time frame, and you keep your, you know, and that's what you do. To if you're, I'm not much of a sailor. You talk about boats, but when somebody taught me to sail, they taught me to, you know, you got to, if you want to hold the tiller in the right place, you got to look where you're going. Otherwise you're gonna be off course, and it's like that's what you're doing, and now it has to change. You know, it's like now it's you know, we don't know how, like I said, I don't know, you know, don't assume. Well, I loved what you said. What did you say? I'm going to reserve hopelessness until it's absolutely necessary.
Yeah, I'm going to like wait to pull that ripcord on the hopelessness until, you know, the data dictates should be doing so. But yeah, just one last thing before we move on to this Grapevine article is I got a call from a sponsee yesterday while I was late making it to a live event that my girlfriend was really banking on being able to make it to. So she was stressed. I was stressed. I was in traffic. There was like 15 things happening at the same time. And my sponsee calls like on the verge of a relapse. And I am trying to kind of access the most wise part of my consciousness while, you know, like really feeling trapped between a rock and a hard place. And I mean, I don't know how well I did. Like, he's sober another day. So I didn't do, must not have done horribly. But I'm sure that Alan will have some smart guy seasoning to add to this about, like, when my number's up and when I actually have to do something and act and kind of like be helpful to somebody else, that moment almost never arrives when I'm like at my best, when I've got my, you know, tie on and I'm sitting calmly in a room with a glass of ice water and just kind of like I don't know, I find myself lately
when you're ready. I'm ready.
I'm never ready. That's what I keep finding, is that like I have to improvise and do the best I can. And I mean, I think there probably is something of emotional sobriety in there, which is that like emotional sobriety is you find that wisdom even when the ground is sliding away beneath you, or that's what we're attempting to do, or develop a practice to kind of be able to act in that way, right?
Well, I think you just gave us another wonderful definition of emotional sobriety. It's being a masterful improviser, because boy, right. If life is anything else, it's improvising.
Learning how to roll with the punches, isn't it? At times, and
exactly that. Yep.
I didn't roll too well about a year and a half ago. I got knocked down a few times, you guys. Thanks for picking me up.
Oh yeah.
What's that sign that Rocky's saying? I love that one from Rocky Balboa.
Oh, it's not how hard you hit, it's how hard you can get hit and get up and keep coming. Yeah.
I'm into that, brother.
Yeah.
I'm into that. I mean, I hope I'm a living example of that right now.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
You too, Tom. I mean, lift it, man. We got hit pretty good, buddy.
Well, and part of it is, and this, I want you to get this, Patrick, because I still, my personal opinion is sometimes you stretch a little farther than I want you to come up with some sort of criticism of yourself. But yeah, you know, I think Alan and I both have. Or good examples recently. It's like one of the things, you know, that I talked about when I first came back from my break, being off with the cancer stuff. When everybody was saying, "Oh man, you were a robot. Oh, what kind of good attitude you had going into that?" And one of the things I wanted everybody to know is I dropped it entirely. I mean. Fuck it. I was lost. I wasn't thinking about emotional sobriety. I wasn't thinking about anything. I was just in shit shape. And the advantage of that, the beauty of that is that I was happy to report that to you guys and to and some other people as well, but that I wasn't ashamed of myself for it. It was just the case. And like, same thing with you, Alan, it's like, you know, knocked down, and get back up. And it's like, how'd you handle that? Well, I don't think I handled that one really well, but I'm still standing.
You are too, Patrick, and I am too, a little wobbly at this point in time, but we're still standing, baby.
Well, what do you say we move on to the next chapter of our series on emotional sobriety in the AA Grapevine? A Dream Come True by Nichelle W. from Collingwood, Ontario. This sober, high-flying pilot has found a loving fellowship in AA meetings all over the world. Before I came into AA in 2002, I'd been to 3 countries. As of today, I've been to 64. This is a dream come true for me. While I was a slave to alcohol, I spoke of traveling the world and living an adventurous life. Of course, none of those dreams materialized, as I was too busy drinking and caught up in the insanity that goes with it. I hit my bottom and was emotionally, mentally, and spiritually bankrupt when I came into the rooms of AA. I surrendered and started doing what was suggested. My recovery included lots of meetings, working with the sponsor, getting into the steps, being of service, and praying. Slowly, as I got healthier in recovery and the fog lifted, my dreams came back to me.
I'm a professional pilot and so grateful I did not lose my career to drinking. Once I had some sober time under my belt, I was fortunate to spend 3 summers in northern Canada working in forest fire suppression. Up to that point, I had been used to living in a large metropolis with multiple AA meetings each day. My home group was an 11-step meeting where we would quietly meditate together as a group. But Northern Canada meetings had a different flavor to them. I loved learning about the spirituality of the local First Nations communities. I was also fortunate to have an opportunity to fly throughout Africa for 5 years in sobriety and 2 years in Afghanistan. I always took grapevines with me, and I left them scattered throughout the world. Throughout my time in Africa, I was not able to attend face-to-face meetings. I'm so grateful to the many online meetings through AA Intergroup. Whether we share via email or video, those meetings were a lifeline.
I've also traveled a lot on my time off. I love going to meetings in other countries, especially in India, where I experience a mix of locals and travelers and many diverse spiritual beliefs. I was fortunate when I was based in Kandahar, Afghanistan. We had 3 meetings a week at the Sober in the Sand group. I love it. Sober in the Sand group. Is that great? Sounds like the Beachcombers traveling spiritual group that Tom went to, right? By your sponsor when he was in Hawaii.
Oh, wow.
In the Sand. All 12-step groups were welcome there. The population at these meetings ranged anywhere from 2 civilian people to 13 combined military and civilians. It was my job in Afghanistan to get our coins engraved. I picked up my 8- and 9-year coins there. I was fortunate in my travels to celebrate 2 years of recovery in Costa Rica. The group there sent around a little clay frog for me and shared their blessings. Isn't that cool? Mm-hmm. That the different rituals and the different in different countries and stuff. It's really neat. In 2014, I moved back to Canada and became an airline pilot. I love going to AA meetings all over the world on layovers. I have been to meetings in English, French, and Spanish. I barely speak Spanish, but I understand the language of the heart. Some meetings can be unique. Some end with the Lord's Prayer, some with the Responsibility Declaration or the Serenity Prayer. Some read How It's Worked. Some simply read the steps and traditions. What is always a constant, no matter where I go in AA, is that whenever I walk in a room, I can deeply exhale.
Mm-hmm.
Deeply exhale. I feel like exhaling now. Wow. Deeply exhale. I know I'm safe and in a spiritual place. I've seen people of every race, religion, social class recover. Alcoholism does not discriminate, and therefore neither can AA. We are united in our recovery.
I'm so grateful that in early sobriety, I read in the big book the idea that we can go anywhere if we are spiritually fit. I'm thankful that my dreams of traveling the world have come true, and going to AA meetings is a huge part of that. I always introduce myself when the chair asks if somebody is visiting from out of town. It provides instant connection and support. We are so fortunate to be part of such a wonderful worldwide fellowship. When I first started coming to AA, they told me you were no longer alone. I had no idea how many years later that would still ring true.
Yeah, you know, it's really great going through the grapevine and hearing you know, so many different perspectives on emotional sobriety. And I'll just kick this off. I mean, you know, I think we could almost say that when she talked about being fit spiritually, and if you're fit spiritually, you can go anywhere, right? The way she said that, I think that's a synonym for emotional sobriety. You see, yeah. One of the things we talk about in emotional sobriety is having a foundation, you know, that is not completely, but for the most part, unshakable. And see, what creates that unshakability, if you will, to our life, right? What do we have to do to be that resilient, to be able to be immune from all of the, I love the way that Don Miguel Ruiz talks about it, of all the poison from other people, or their black magic, right? Their black magic and poison, right? How can we be immune from it? Well, it is the promise of emotional sobriety, that we don't have to drink that poison, that we don't have to take what they're doing personally. Sometimes that's a big challenge, man. You know, I've gone through this situation with my divorce and the circumstances around that. And I'll tell you, man, it's only recently that I've started taking it a lot less personally. You know, I've taken this very personally for a long time. So sometimes I can stop taking something personal like that. Bigger issues take a lot longer for me. Like I said, I'm a year and a half into this journey, and it's only now that I'm starting to not take it as personally as I was. I'd say I'm probably maybe 70% there, maybe on a good day, 80%. So I've come a long way from taking it all personally. Like, you know, like, how could you do this to me instead of you're doing this? What does it say about you, not about me? So that's the thing I get out of this. I think she's talking about the consciousness that we've talked about a lot of times, is that breaking up that consciousness that says, I'm okay if. The consciousness of what I like to think of as contingency, right? That my well-being is so contingent upon my perfectionist dreams and specifications. And until I start to surrender those things and unhook people from it, I can't really be spiritually fit nor emotionally sober.
Right. Yeah.
Yeah. It's a bit of that. I don't know if it's Eckhart Tolle, but wherever you go, there you are. Yes. He probably praised it from somebody else. But yeah, like what I got from the Grapevine article, besides the wonderful fact that, you know, you can find a fellowship anywhere and everywhere. And that's, you know, part of what's so great about it. Aside from the internet, you know, AA is this kind of these wonderful branches that it just seems to extend everywhere throughout the world. But yeah, like if emotional sobriety is about moving away from environmental support and towards self-support, this idea of just basically of recovery being an inner negotiation, and something that can occur in any environment. I think, it's really central to emotional sobriety. And like, I certainly, you know, without getting into too much of an injury tangent, I've had to change my geographics a bit because of my recent injuries and different life circumstances. Like my daily schedule, it just feels like it's always in flux. And, you know, I work from home. I end up kind of living out of a suitcase and crashing a bunch of different places. But like, back to improvisation, I'm just always kind of improvising a recovery schedule as well, right? Mm-hmm. And like, which meetings can I get to this week? Will I be doing virtual? Will I be doing in person at this place or that place to see my sponsor or to be reading the book with somebody else? It's the type of thing that when we can have a run a tight ship and keep a consistent schedule, all the better. But for those of us who have to do it in for the far flung corners of the globe, or have to, you know, our schedule is kind of like thrown into disarray because like we have some like intense life circumstance, like some that we've just gone through recently. it's still possible to find that emotional sobriety, find that recovery, you know, even if the circumstances of it need to change a little bit, right?
Well, that's a great point. We really saw in what she said is her, first of all, her commitment to recovery is how, regardless of the situation she was in, she would improvise and find a way to stay connected to her recovery and to her program. And so that's a good point, Patrick. It's a real good point, is that we really have to have an unwavering commitment to our recovery if it's going to work.
You know, I think back to when I was first in recovery before, you know, somebody, before they invented the technology, and everybody had everybody's phone numbers on a paper in their pocket.
Didn't they have like carrier pigeons back in your day? You just tie a message.
No,
to their,
they had not. They had not trained the pigeons yet. That came. I was older by the time they started using pigeons. We mainly just guessed. You know, that was pretty much it. It's like that's why I still do it that way. So your knees change, and you're improvising, but you improvise basically to move to another plan also. So what you end up having is a broader catalog of options for meetings. You know, I've got these meetings in different locations. I know about these meetings online. I know about these meetings. I know this recovery support through email. It's like, the woman in with the article, of course, I mean, she had this international catalog of places, you know, that she had been. I've always loved the idea that I'm a member of an international group and I can go any place in the world and not even speak their language and walk in someplace and feel at home. But I've not experienced it like she described it. And I think that's wonderful, but it's adapting your support system to your circumstances. You know, I work a lot with people, I've worked frequently with people who have relapse problems. I tell them that they have a separate thing from an addiction. Is I call it relapse syndrome, and say we have to address that differently. And a lot of times one of the things we have to look at is people are kind of, are stilted. They're not flexible, as long as everything's working for them, as long as the meetings that they usually go to are available, as long as they can do that and nothing interrupts that, they're fine. But if something else happens, they don't think on their feet, kind of thing. And but the other thing I wanted to say real quick while I'm saying on that subject, because she really spoke to this, is the other thing I find working with relapse folks is one of the most important things is I look at their motivation, not motivation to be sober first, just their motivation to be alive and on earth. And so often the people who are relapsing, and I'm not saying this is always it, but so often we can dig in there and we can find that there are these unfulfilled dreams that have been shut down. These unfulfilled desires that people have had in their lives, they may not even be conscious of them again now, but basically what I, you know, the way I said it to a fellow the other day is like, you know, if we need to switch this so you need to go after this stuff that you've always wanted rather than just be by default in the family business, you know, because otherwise, if it's nothing but boredom, you're going to drink. You know, it's like you're too bored with life. Let's get something going that you actually want to do, and that becomes. I know that's true for me she said she talked about traveling until she got so. I talked about writing. I was all I was going to be is I was always going to be a writer. I never meant to be a therapist. It's a total accident, but I was going to be a writer, and I wrote constantly, but I never finished anything. But I talked always about, you know, about writing and publishing, and of course I never finished anything until I got sober, and certainly never came close to publishing anything until I was sober.
That's it, man.
There's really a fighting chance,
yeah,
with sobriety and recovery.
Yeah, emotional sobriety too. It's really supporting ourselves. You know, I talk about that a lot at 12 Essential Insights.
Yep.
Is that self-support is so important in emotional sobriety. It's the ability to stand with ourselves and stand for ourselves, not against anybody, but to stand for ourselves in life and to support ourselves, to support getting our dreams, meeting our dreams, fulfilling our dreams, dealing with the trauma that we need to deal with, whatever comes up. Self-support is the key into this whole thing. The other thing that stood out for me in this, and then we can wrap this up today, is that she talks about feeling at home.
Mm-hmm.
Like she finally found a place where she feels like she's accepted. And look, this is where what we talked about is environmental support can be helpful at the beginning, is to be accepted by the group. But eventually that acceptance in the group has to become self-acceptance for you to have emotional sobriety. Because if it depends on the group and then all of a sudden somebody doesn't accept you in the group, right? And something happens, then what goes on? You know, then you lose that sense of being at home, right? And so that being at home has to be something within, not without. Even though at the beginning, it's okay if it's what we call a piece of external recovery capital. But eventually that has to be internalized.
Absolutely.
We call it a good interjection rather than a bad interjection, right? So I love doing this. So we're on. Well, next week it'll be, I think we should be able to pull it off. I'll be finishing up my retreat. I'll have to do it from the car, but there's no reason why we can't do that.
That'd be wonderful. Right. I know everybody misses us when we're away. So we'll strive to keep having, bringing the best of ourselves to this as often as we can.
Oh, we're supposed to bring our best of ourselves?
Well, well, Tom, we'll accept some mid, Tom. That's okay.
You just got to give me the rules, man. I don't know. Okay. All right.
Tend your life. Tend your myth. Cultivate your narrative with whomever you are.